of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free of all minds. These are weapons of mass
descent. These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Deep down, a story from the heart of coal country, remembering the late Chalmers Johnson. Plus, after the Senate approves a new settlement, will black farmers finally win redress? And this week's People's Marketplace.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Chalmers Johnson, foreign policy expert and lifelong intellectual, died on Saturday, November 20th at the age of 79. He survived by his wife, Sheila. Johnson was a veteran of the Korean War, a consultant to the CIA from 1967 to 73, and an academic. He chaired the Center for Chinese Studies at UC Berkeley from 1967 to 72, and in 1988 he moved to UC San Diego to join the newly opened School of International Relations and Pacific Studies. He retired from academia in 1992 and founded the Japan Policy Research Institute. Chalmers Johnson was considered a vanguard intellectual in the development of nations, especially in Asia. Steve Clemens, a student and longtime friend of Johnson, said of his impact, "From my perspective, he rivals Henry Kissinger as the most significant intellectual force who has shaped and defined the fundamental boundaries and goalposts of U.S. foreign policy in the modern era. Johnson was an apostate and heretic in the field of political economy. He challenged conventional wisdom, writing the significant treatises documenting the growing prevalence of state-led industrial and trade and finance policy abroad, particularly in Asia," end of quote. In 1995, the brutal rape of a 12-year-old Japanese girl by two U.S. soldiers stationed in Okinawa, Japan, spurred a fundamental shift in Johnson's view toward American foreign policy. He argued against the presence of U.S. military bases around the world, viewing them as unnecessary and destructive. He wrote and lectured frequently about the United States' slide towards imperialism and the embrace of a perpetual war state. Johnson was perhaps best known for his 2000 book, Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. The book did not receive wide attention until after the events of 9/11, when it was instantly seen as prophetic and became a bestseller. Following Blowback, Chalmers Johnson wrote the books The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, and his last book just released this past August, Dismantling the Empire, America's Last Best Hope. Today, we're going to remember Chalmers Johnson by playing for you excerpts of a talk that he gave, as well as an excerpt of an interview that I did with him. He spoke on March 18th, 2007 at the San Diego First Unitarian Universalist Church about his book Nemesis, and in these opening minutes of his talk, he discusses the earlier book that made him a household name, Blowback.
History tells us that one of the most unstable political combinations is a country like the United States today, that tries to be both a domestic democracy and a foreign imperialist. But why this is so can be a very abstract subject. I think that the best way to introduce this is to say a few words about my new book, Nemesis, and try to explain why I gave it the subtitle, The Last Days of the American Republic. I do mean it. It's serious. It's not just hype to sell books. Nemesis is the third of three books that have grown out of my research over the past 8 years. I did not set out to write a trilogy on the increasingly dangerous threats to our democracy, but as I uncovered the legacy of our imperialist pressures on many other countries and the nature and size of our military empire, one book led to the other. Professionally, I'm a specialist in the history and politics of East Asia. In the year 2000, I published a book called Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, because my research on China, Japan, and the two Koreas persuaded me that our policies there would have serious future consequences. The book got good reviews, but not until after 9/11 did Blowback become a household word and my book a bestseller. In this book, I set out to explain why we are hated around the world. The concept blowback, a CIA term, does not mean just retaliation for things our government has done to and in foreign countries. It refers to retaliation for the numerous illegal operations we've carried out abroad that were kept totally secret from the American public. These operations include the clandestine overthrows of governments we do not like. In fact, the word blowback was used in the after-action report of the first of these, that is the overthrow of the Iranian government for the sake of the British Petroleum Company in 1953. The after-action report was just declassified in the year 2000. Clandestine overthrow of governments, training foreign militaries in the techniques of state terrorism, rigging elections in foreign countries, interfering with the economic viability of countries that seem to threaten the interests of American companies, and the torture and assassination of selected foreigners. The fact that these actions are secret means that when the retaliation comes, as it did so spectacularly on September 11th, 2001, the American public is unable to put the events in context, so they tend to support acts intended to lash out against the alleged perpetrators, thereby commonly preparing the ground for yet another cycle of blowback. After this book, and as a continuation of the analysis started there, I began doing research on the network of 737 American military bases we maintain around the world. That is according to the most recent Pentagon survey or inventory. It's the base structure report. It's unclassified. 737. There are quite a few, actually more than that, but that's the official number. Regardless of the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, we now station over 500,000 U.S. troops, spies, contractors, dependents, and others on military bases located in more than 130 countries, many of them presided over by dictatorial regimes that have given their citizens no say in the decision to let us in. My research into our base world resulted in my second book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, which was published early in 2004. It was written, however, during the run-up to the Iraq invasion, and that led to some further discussion. Some people question whether what we do abroad as a nation can be called imperialism. The British ruled India, much of Africa, large swaths of the Middle East, through their colonies. They did not dominate these places through consent, but through direct military force. Similarly, the Dutch dominated Indonesia, the French Indochina and Algeria, the Japanese, Korea, and Taiwan. These two we recognize as empires. But what the Russians had in Eastern Europe, the system of satellites from Bulgaria to East Germany, ruled through the Soviet Red Army, was also a form of empire. Moscow dominated these countries through huge military forces stationed on their borders or based in their territories, local pro-Soviet puppets, and economic integration into the Soviet bloc system. This is the sort of empire the U.S. has created and is now trying to maintain by way of its military forces and its bases and threats such as those it issues daily against Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, the Palestinians, and other regimes we don't approve of. To do this, the president has assumed powers specifically denied him by our Constitution, and the Congress abdicated its responsibilities to balance the power of the executive branch. Despite the Democratic sweep in the 2006 election, it remains to be seen whether these tendencies can be reversed or controlled. We have a perfectly good means in the Constitution for getting rid of unsatisfactory political leaders. It's called impeachment. In her first speech, Speaker Pelosi said, impeachment is off the table. If impeachment is off the table, then maybe the Republic is off the table.
The late Chalmers Johnson speaking on March 18, 2007 in San Diego about his book Nemesis. In continuing to discuss his book in the same talk, he summarized the impact of the Bush administration in a description that sounds quite relevant even today.
Until the 2004 presidential election, ordinary citizens of the United States could at least claim that our foreign policy, including our illegal invasion of Iraq, was the work of George Bush's administration, and that we had not put him in office. In 2000, Bush lost the popular vote and was appointed president thanks to the intervention of the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision. But in November 2004, regardless of claims about voter fraud, Bush actually won the popular vote by well over 3.5 million ballots, making his regime and his wars ours. Whether Americans intended it or not, we are now seen around the world as approving the torture of captives at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, at Bagram Air Base in Kabul, at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and at secret CIA prisons around the world, as well as having endorsed Bush's claim that as commander-in-chief in wartime, he is beyond all constraints of the Constitution or international law. As he has repeatedly said to us, I am the decider. It's hard to think of something more anti-constitutional than that remark. That is, there is no decider in our Constitution. Decisions are taken by consensus. It was structured that way in order to prevent the rise of a tyrant or a dictator. We are now saddled with a rigged economy based on record-setting trade and fiscal deficits, the most secretive and intrusive American government in memory, the pursuit of preventive war as a basis for foreign policy, and a potential epidemic of nuclear proliferation as other nations attempt to adjust to and defend themselves from our own behavior, while our own already staggering nuclear arsenal expands toward first-strike primacy, and we expend unimaginable billions on warfare in outer space. In Nemesis, I present historical, political, economic, and philosophical evidence of where our current behavior is likely to lead. Specifically, I believe that maintaining our empire abroad requires resources and commitments that will inevitably undercut our domestic democracy and in the end produce a military dictatorship or its civilian equivalent. The combination of huge standing armies, almost continuous wars, our growing economic dependence on the military-industrial complex, and ruinous military expenses are destroying a Republican structure in favor of an imperial presidency. By imperial structure, I mean, of course, the separation of powers and elaborate checks and balances that the founders of our country wrote into the Constitution as the main bulwarks against dictatorship and tyranny. We are on the brink of losing our democracy for the sake of keeping our empire. Once a nation starts down that path, the dynamics that apply to all empires come into play. Isolation, overstretch, the uniting of forces opposed to imperialism, and bankruptcy. History is intrusive on this dilemma. If we choose to keep our empire, as the Roman Republic did, we will certainly lose our democracy and grimly await the eventual blowback that imperialism generates.
And that is, again, the late Chalmers Johnson speaking on March 18th, 2007 in San Diego about his book Nemesis. Special thanks to Global Voices for Justice for providing this clip. On January 8, 2008, I interviewed Chalmers Johnson after the film Charlie Wilson's War was released. In this excerpt from my interview with him, he summarized the history of U.S. policy in Afghanistan.
The President of the United States, George H.W. Bush, lost all interest in Afghanistan and simply walked away. The place descended into probably as fierce and unpleasant a civil war as been seen anywhere on earth in the last century or two. The Afghans that we had supported, our allies, one of which was, of course, the prominent and pious Saudi economist and engineer Osama bin Laden, because the Saudi Arabia matched every dollar that we spent in Afghanistan, and he was strongly supported by his home government as well as by the intelligence agencies of Pakistan, through whom all weapons going to the Afghans were funneled. That they became disgusted with us and began to retaliate. This retaliation has included many different attacks against us by al-Qaeda throughout the 1990s and culminated, of course, most spectacularly in the attack of September 11th, 2001. The best book on this is a book by Steve Cole, a former managing editor of the Washington Post, called Ghost Wars, the subtitle of which is, I can't remember the exact words, but it's the Soviet Union in Afghanistan from its intervention in 1979 through to September 10th, 2001. I think that all of us are saying about the Kreil book is that he should have done the same thing. The story doesn't end when he wants to end it, and it's only in doing that that it looks like we know what we're doing. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it was that is the argument that would I think anybody who's looked at it closely today would make. The CIA was politically stupid about all of this. They knew very little about Afghanistan. They knew very little about the part of the world they were working in. They knew very little about the people they were collaborating with, namely the ISI, the Inter Services Intelligence Agency, run by the Pakistan military, and that William Casey, the director of Central Intelligence, who, after all, lived in a mansion in Long Island called Mary Knoll, filled with statues of the Virgin Mary. He was an extremely passionate and devout Catholic who believed that the true answer to communism in Nicaragua, wherever else it might be, was the Catholic Church. He realized he couldn't convert the Afghans to Catholicism, but he nonetheless took the view that so long as they were religious and reflected religious impulses, that they were useful to him, they could be used against godless communists. This was crazy, absurd, and a typical ideological confusion in American foreign policy, and we're paying the costs of it still to this day.
And that's the voice of the late Chalmers Johnson. I spoke with him on January 8th, 2008, in this excerpt of the interview. And he passed away this past Saturday, November 20th, at the age of 79. He's perhaps best known for his books Blowback, as well as Nemesis and Dismantling the Empire, which was his latest book that was just released in August. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we'll take a look at a new Senate settlement and see whether black farmers will, after many decades, finally win redress. We'll also play this week's People's Marketplace. And after this short break, Deep Down, a story from the heart of coal country. It's a new documentary, and the filmmakers join me in studio. Stay tuned.
Hi, Shubi Steininger. This is Maggie LaPeak. I'm a music director here at KPFK. You are the winner of the John Lennon Signature Box Set.
Oh, my God, are you kidding me?
No, I'm serious.
No.
We offered it on our John Lennon Day, which was from 12 noon to 12 midnight.
That was my birthday.
Wow.
That day made my birthday so special. I wanted to call and thank you guys for that programming. It was fantastic. I listened to it all day. As a matter of fact, my friends had to drag me out of the house to have a birthday dinner because I didn't want to leave.
Wow, that's really wonderful to hear. The set contains 8 original albums digitally remastered. Thank you so much for your support of this radio station.
And my phone is programmed. It said KPFK because I have you programmed in my phone because I donate regularly.
I'm Cornel West, and you're listening to Uprising with Sister Sonali Kolhatkar on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
The chief executive of Massey Energy, the owner of the Big Branch coal mine where an explosion killed 29 workers in April, complained last week that his company was facing financial problems due to what he called a reg session. Don Blankenship argued that too much regulation, not the recession, was hurting Massey's profits and said it was time to consider rolling back some of the rules governing the industry. The explosion at the Big Branch mine in West Virginia was the deadliest since 1970. Immediately after the tragedy, Massey Energy began denying culpability. However, industry watchdogs uncovered evidence that the company routinely ignored safety protocols in favor of faster production and higher profits. Investigations into the Big Branch explosion are still underway while the debate surrounding coal mining continues at the highest levels of government and between neighbors in what is known as coal country. This debate is showcased in the documentary film Deep Down, a story from the heart of coal country. Deep Down is an intimate portrayal of one Appalachian community in eastern Kentucky that is divided over the method known as mountaintop removal. The film will be broadcast nationally tonight on PBS's Independent Lens. Deep Down focuses on two lifelong friends, Beverly and Terry. Beverly is organizing a community campaign to stop the expansion of mining operations, a campaign that is opposed by those who depend on mining for their paycheck. Terry is considering leasing his land to be mined and sacrificing the environment he loves for the financial payoffs he's being promised. My guests are the filmmakers, the two directors of the documentary. Sally Rubin is the co-director, editor, and full-time film professor at Chapman University. And Jen Gilliman is the co-director, cinematographer, and director of public media strategies at the Bay Area Video Coalition. Welcome to Uprising, Sally and Jen.
Thanks.
So this film is a very interesting story about an issue that many Americans don't know much about, yet it touches most of our lives because coal is what powers still a majority of the electricity in the country. How did it take two California women to go to Kentucky on the other side of the country? What drove you to make this film about this story?
A number of things, and we often get asked that question. Jen's actually from rural Illinois. She's from Peoria, where Caterpillar is the main industry, and that's that they make mountaintop removal mining equipment, the machinery. And my family's actually from East Tennessee. So I had spent a lot of time in Appalachia growing up and spent time in eastern Kentucky actually working on a film called Country Boys. So we wanted to make a film really about socioeconomic class in America. How do you do that in a way that can be moving and compelling, that isn't just sort of a survey film? And we found the story of Maytown and knew once we met Beverly May that this was our film.
And so what's impressive about the film is that it allows the viewer to make their decisions about what's at stake. Can you tell us about Terry, who is the friend of the anti-mining activist Beverly, who's considering leasing his land to the mining company because he is in dire straits financially? How do these mining companies, if you will, prey on the poverty of these communities?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about Terry is that he has a really strong connection to his land, and yet he was considering leasing it to create this mountaintop removal coal mine. But he really sees a bigger picture view, and he sees the complexities of this whole situation, and he feels ultimately powerless because he's basically caught up in this huge machine that was built to mine coal. And so when he considers leasing his land, he feels like he's got just a thumbnail. He keeps showing his thumbnail, you know, on this giant map of this mountaintop removal coal mine that the company hopes to create. And he says, this is all I can say is don't mine this piece of land or go ahead and mine it. Either way, he feels like he's going to have to deal with all the impacts of the mining. So why shouldn't he benefit from it in some way? He's got these huge corporations that are going to ultimately benefit from, you know, extracting the coal from his property. But if he didn't lease his land to mine, he was going to have to deal with all of the consequences without having any payout at all.
What role does the culture of the area, the fact that the communities are so tight-knit and have lived there for generations, what role does that play in this story?
It plays definitely a big role in that that's what's at stake. You know, that's really what's at stake here. Many films have been made before about the effects of mountaintop removal mining. Many will be continued to be made about the scientific effects, the health effects. But we really wanted to make one that talked about the culture and what we really stand to lose as a country, actually. But we had to be sort of subtle about it. We didn't want to just sort of blanket the film with a bunch of, you know, banjo playing and fiddle playing, everything you're sort of used to seeing. We wanted to do it in a more subtle way. So yeah, it's in fact really what's at the heart of the film.
I want to play for our listeners an excerpt of the documentary Deep Down, a Story from the Heart of Coal Country, directed by my guests Sally Rubin and Jen Gilliman. In this excerpt, we hear the voices of many of the residents of the area of Maytown in Kentucky, as well as some of the proponents of coal mining, talk about what's at stake. Here's an excerpt of Deep Down, which, by the way, is airing on PBS's Independent Lunch tonight.
My family's lived in Maytown and Wilson Creek for 225 years, and the thought of someone else destroying the land, it makes me sick. And I hope that Almighty God also holds those same people responsible. And I think He will.
Folks, if people think our economy is bad now, just realize how bad it would be without the mining industry in this area. I feel God put coal and other natural resources on this earth for a purpose. That purpose is to use for energy requirements and jobs.
It's Wilson Creek. We identify who we are and the places that we live by the creeks or the watersheds that we live on. When does the time come that employment does not always have to pit communities and workers against each other? And when we say coal is the only job that we have, why is coal the only job that we have? After 100 years, you would have think it would have brought some prosperity to this region instead of destruction.
I am a single mother. I'm not a victim in any way, shape, or form. I'm very proud of living in Eastern Kentucky. My mama used to work on a surface mine. Coal has always put bread on my family's table and still does. And I'm very passionate about feeding my children.
To the miners, we're not against you. I've got family working in the mines, but you know what's going on in my neighborhood.
If everybody had the same attitude that they didn't want their community disturbed because of strip mining or what we'd be tonight, I tell you, we'd be in the dark. Because the truth of the matter is, it is a dirty thing sometimes. It's not very clean sometimes. But it's the best product we have. And until something better comes along, we have to use what we got.
And that's an excerpt of the documentary Deep Down, a story from the heart of coal country. It's going to be airing on PBS's Independent Lens tonight at 10 p.m. in most markets. You can check your local station guide or go to pbs.org/independentlens/deep-down to find out exactly when it's airing in your area. We'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. I'm joined in studio by the two filmmakers, by the co-directors of the documentary, Sally Rubin and Jen Gilliman. Let's talk about Beverly May and the organizing against mountaintop removal. So on the one hand, we talked about Terry, the man who sort of feels like he's caught in this tight spot with the energy companies on one side and the promise of some kind of financial compensation on the other. And then Beverly May, she is not so tortured, if you will, in her decision. She's very clear cut. What is her position and how did she arrive at it?
Yeah, so Beverly, like Terry, has grown up in Maytown. And, I mean, the town is basically named after her ancestors. Beverly May is her name. And her family lives all right around her there. And when we met her, she basically said, "Over my dead body, will this happen in my holler?" And
which is the word for holler is?
Holler is the word for basically the long, narrow tract between the mountains.
Like a valley.
The Appalachian Mountains are formed like long ridges. So people tend to live in the hollers, and it's usually where the water runs down through this amazing biosphere.
And when the mountaintop removal happens, those watersheds and those areas get completely polluted.
Completely, yeah. So Beverly takes a very strong position early on in this story, and she decides that she's going to try to organize her community to fight against the mine and to basically stop it. So she uses various tactics to do that, and you know, she really emerges as a leader in her community through this story. And, you know, we were in Chicago this weekend showing the film to folks there and looking at sort of the community on the other end of this cycle. So she got to meet some of the organizers, community organizers there in South Chicago where some of these power plants are. And, you know, she said before the film and before all of this happened, I really couldn't even stand public speaking. But she... you know, she really is a leader now, and it's been incredible to watch. But what I think is so special about Beverly is that she does the really hard kind of community organizing, which is going door to door, talking to her neighbors, telling them why she takes the position that she does and, you know, what she feels is at stake, not just for herself, but for everybody in town. And she cares about the miners, too. You know, she's a community health practitioner. She treats many of the miners who get black lung or rock lung from working in the mines. And, you know, she feels like the best way to do community organizing is by bringing people together rather than dividing them.
So in this whole story, where are the mining companies themselves? And how did you portray them or not in your documentary, Sally?
Well, we were lucky in that it's legal to film public hearings. So we didn't have to worry about access. We would sort of post a note, notice of filming, but basically we had access to all of those conversations that are in the film, like the clip you just played. So we really were able to hear the other side in a more formal, structured way.
But were those the CEOs of the companies? I suppose there was the vice president of one of the companies who did actually come and speak.
Yeah, sometimes they were the higher-ups. There were a couple of workers who spoke, but yeah, mainly it was sort of the higher-ups in the company. We did go to the Miller Brothers Coal Company in particular again and again and again over the course of the 2 years and finally talked to the vice president. We finally got him on the phone, and he just said, look, I'd love to help you. But I can't, you know, they just couldn't because they were afraid of losing their jobs. Both the sort of the men lower down in the company and also even the people running the companies, they just could not talk to us on film. So eventually we did get an interview in a scene with a mining engineer who we met. And that's sort of the closest you get to really hearing the other side in person in the film.
There's an interesting part in the film during these public hearings where someone defending the mining practice says that, you know, the coal is what lights people's homes. And until something better comes along, it's the best thing we've got. And that's the dilemma that's presented. But is that really a truthful dilemma? I mean, there are better options. It's just they aren't taken up because they might not be as profitable, et cetera.
Right. So mountaintop removal evolved because it's basically a cheap and quick way to get the coal out of the mountains. It doesn't mean it's a good environmental practice by any means. But I think one of the complexities of the story is just that we are all connected to this. You know, it's crazy that we flip on the lights over here in California and that's coal coming from these mountains. So, you know, while it is true that there are alternative energies available to us, they're not always available to us immediately like that. You know, we have to demand alternative energies and other forms of energy, sustainable ones, you know, ones that don't consume the mountains in this way. So, you know, the jobs argument is one component of it, but it's not, it's usually the main one that's highlighted by the folks from the industry. But it's really a fallacy. Like the number of jobs have just declined and declined over the years as it gets more and more industrialized.
And one speaker said, you know, where has the prosperity gone? If we've been doing this for 100 years and coal is supposed to put food on our tables, I suppose that's just barely what it does, but nothing more, right? It hasn't actually enriched the communities beyond, you know, the levels that they've been at for many, many decades.
Yeah, one person in the film says we're getting pennies when major dollars are being taken out of here, and that's the bottom line.
And it's part of the sacrifice that the entire region has made for the country. And, you know, it's the miners and the folks who have to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. It's a huge sacrifice they've made.
How do the coal companies also take advantage of people who own the land, people like Terry, because it puts him in a very difficult spot? And are they even extremely honest, if you will, in their dealings?
It's complicated. You know, I don't think anyone there sort of deliberately outright lies, but there's a lot of back and forth. And again, there's a quote in the film about, you know, this place is formed on living in a community, living in a small community, and the values here, you shake someone's hand and, you know, a man's handshake is as good as his word and as good as any document that a courthouse could produce. And, you know, that's sort of how this place is run. And so, right, when these big companies come in and they're trying to have people sign away their land, it does get very it gets really complicated. And what happens in the film is that Terry's offered for $75,000 for his land, and he considers taking it, but he doesn't. He waits. He sort of drives a hard bargain. And then, you know, the man comes back, drives up the driveway there, comes back. Now the deal's a little bit less. Now it's $30,000.
Wow.
And, you know, then he leaves and comes back again. Now it's $12,000. So it's not so much lying. It's more slippery tactics and tactics that people there really aren't used to. So it's confusing for people.
And we should clarify that he was never actually offered money outright. It's all speculation because people only get paid by the amount of coal that's hauled off their property. So people could actually form a contract with the company that is say, $1 per ton of coal that's hauled off their land. Now, the people who are tracking those amounts is the coal company itself. Mm. And the coal company may actually be aware that there's no coal beneath that person's property, but they plan to use the person's property as a dumping ground, basically. So the document will say, in addition to being able to haul the coal off the person's land, they can also leave the waste there, which means that people may sign away and never receive a dime from the company for creating basically a valley fill in their backyard, for example, which mm-hmm. happened one holler over. We got to meet a gentleman who did that.
Well, listeners will have to watch the film to find out what happens. I want to ask the two of you finally about the way in which you made the film. It's very intimate. The camera work is amazing. You tried to pick up on, I noticed through your film work, through the use of the camera, the way in which human beings struggle with themselves and with these decisions. And in the end, it becomes an intensely personal film. Was that something you intended right from the start?
We did. We always wanted that. And our mentors and, you know, people whose films we admire and wanted to mimic definitely did that. We always were frustrated by wanting to be going deeper. I remember once halfway through the film, Jen and I sort of looking at each other. The film hadn't yet been funded by the Independent Television Service, and the story really was going nowhere, and the subjects, Terry and Beverly, sort of weren't talking to us. And I remember looking at each other at about midnight one night in Kentucky and just saying, you know, we said we wanted to make an intimate portrait and there's nothing here that's intimate and we don't even have a portrait. And then just sort of going to sleep and having to get up the next day and keep shooting, you know. Definitely that was what we were going after. And I think, you know, we shot over 200 hours, more like 250 hours of footage for the hour-long film. And the fact is there's a lot in those 250 hours that isn't necessarily intimate. What you've got is an hour that's sort of finely cut where you have the best of those moments.
Mm-hmm. And it evolved over time. I mean, we really built relationships with our subjects that, I mean, we really care about them. And we consider ourselves part of their families now. I mean, we got to film, you know, Terry's daughter's wedding, and they wanted us there whether we were going to be filming or not. So, you know, we really care about the region and the people there.
Finally, where can listeners find out more, not only about the film, but about the organizing on a national level that they might like to get involved in from here in California?
Yeah, well, ilovemountains.org is a great resource. People can plug in their own zip code and see how they're connected to the coal, like where their coal comes from that powers their house. And Beverly and I also just participated in this thing called Appalachia Rising, which was a big kind of uprising in D.C. We went and got arrested at the White House together, and it was really a culminating moment, I think, for a lot of folks that came from the mountains and came from the coal fields. You know, there was a lot of emotional moments over that weekend of people feeling finally like there is a really big movement and it's national, and people had come from all over to be there in solidarity with them. So I think it really is a shifting tide right now.
Yeah, we covered Appalachia Rising on our program. And is there a website for your film?
Yeah, the website is www.deepdownfilm.org. And if you go to the blog section, we actually posted a video that we shot and cut about that Appalachia Rising, and you can see Jen and Beverly getting arrested on video. It's pretty cool.
Wow, very good. Well, deepdownfilm.org again is the website, but listeners can catch the film on television tonight. It's going to be airing on PBS's Independent Lens. It's at 10 p.m. in most markets, but you should check your local station guide to find out exactly when it's airing in your area at pbs.org/independentlens/deep-down. We'll link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today if you missed it. Sally and Jen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
My guests have been Sally Rubin, the editor and editor and co-director of the documentary. She's also a full-time film professor at Chapman University, and Jen Gilliman is the co-director of the film and cinematographer. She's also the director of public media strategies at the Bay Area Video Coalition. This is Uprising. After this week's People's Marketplace, will there be justice for Black farmers? Stay tuned to find out.
Why can't I ever come out ahead of the bank?
Those guys are all crooks.
We want to take out a hefty loan.
Giant secret charges may apply.
Money! Loan denied.
Oh, my God!
Money! But I want you to be so nice so I could save money.
Money makes the world go around.
While pundits and economists worry about Wall Street's well-being, Americans worry about losing their jobs, paying their bills, and the health of the planet. The capitalist marketplace promotes the exploitation of people and natural resources as cheap fixes. But we don't have to abandon our values to save a buck. Welcome to The People's Marketplace. I'm Martina Steiner. Do you get some of your holiday spirit from a bottle? Whether you sip on a glass of wine to enhance the merriment or spike the eggnog to take the edge off a long family day, drink Union Made. Lots of beverages are made by Union shops, and many are as cheap as they come. When it comes to beer, Anheuser-Busch products are made by members of the International Aerospace and Machinists Union, or IAM. This includes the American Standard Budweiser and Bud Light, as well as Rolling Rock and the non-alcoholic O'Doul's. Check out the Campus Progress website at www.campusprogress.org, where the writers have done extensive research on drinking union. Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, the $2 a pint staple of dive bars everywhere, is made by hardworking members of the United Auto Workers. Revel in the irony the next time you call a cab after downing too many. You can find other United Auto Worker-made beverages and food products by going to their website at www.uaw.org. Not surprisingly, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union is the muscle behind a full bar of beverages. If you like your whiskey or bourbon on the cheaper side, they make Wild Turkey and Jim Beam Black Label, White, or Rye. And you can chase it all down with a Barks Root Beer. Or get a little fancy with Knob Creek Bourbon. You can also get your UFCW-made jollies on with Captain Morgan Rum or El Jimador Tequila. Find the many other UFCW products at www.ufcw.org. When it comes to wine, finding Union Made is difficult, but not because a glass of red doesn't go with a blue collar. The wine industry relies on grape pickers who are largely seasonal migrant workers and hard to organize. The United Farm Workers have had a rocky relationship with the Charles Krug Mondavi Winery and the behemoth Ernest & Gallo Empire. In 2008, the UFW successfully negotiated a four-year contract with Charles Krug Mondavi, which had long fought unionization. Their relationship with Ernest & Gallo is on again, off again. But the next time you're pacing the beer aisle, if you want to be sure and do good, abstain from anything made by Coors. Sobering investigative articles found on both Campus Progress and Alternate.org reveal that the Coors family is a right-wing family. The Coors family has a long and continuing tradition of funding right-wing foundations, think tanks, and causes. Joseph Coors was a member of Ronald Reagan's kitchen cabinet, which could even be one of his more center-right positions. So, when you top off your holiday with a beverage, make sure it's Union Made. Try it and stretch your dollar to meet your values. For the People's Marketplace, this is Martina Steiner.
Thanks, Martina. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. The Senate on November 19th approved a funding bill to fulfill two settlements previously awarded in two separate class action discrimination suits brought against federal agencies. In total, the Senate approved over $5.3 billion in settlements. Of that, $3.4 billion was approved for Native Americans represented under the settlement reached last year in Cobell versus Salazar. That suit was brought against the Department of the Interior in 1996 by Eloise Cobell, a member of the Blackfeet tribe from Browning, Montana. The Cobell suit argued that the Department of the Interior owed royalty payments for land use for oil, gas, and grazing rights to hundreds of thousands of Native Americans. Funding for Cobell must now be approved by the House. The Senate bill also authorized $1.5 billion to go toward black farmers represented under what is known as the Pigford II case. The original Pigford suit was brought against the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1997 by Tim Pigford of North Carolina and a group of black farmers. Prior to the Pigford suit, a USDA investigation uncovered decades of systemic discrimination against generations of black farmers, leading to the denial of loans or unfair loan terms. The original Pigford lawsuit included 22,000 farmers and was settled for $2.3 billion. However, the terms of the settlement were criticized, and a majority of farmers who applied for Pigford money were found ineligible on what they complained were bureaucratic technicalities. This year, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack and Attorney General Eric Holder approved a second settlement of $1.15 billion for additional claimants known as the Pigford II. However, approval for the funding had been held up in the Senate until last week. My guest is John Boyd. He's the president of the National Black Farmers Association. Welcome to Uprising, John.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So what does this this decision by the Senate actually represent in this very longstanding fight for the rights of black farmers?
We had a very, very tough time in the Senate where the bill failed 9 times previously in the Senate. And Friday's vote was the 10th time it came to the floor and finally passed by unanimous consent. The bill passed previously in the House twice, once in the tax extenders and the other time in the war bill. So it has to be still has to be reconciled in the House. But we just had such a tough time in the Senate, and I'm very pleased that finally Republicans and Democrats seem to put down their fighting swords and make some peace to get this done for black farmers and Native Americans. But the worst part is that so many farmers have died at the plow waiting for this justice to come forward, and it's just taking too long, especially with the fact that we have a settlement agreement, we have a judgment in federal court, and we've done everything right here, and still we've had a uphill battle, even with the support of the White House as well.
Now, why was the original settlement not enough? Why were so many farmers denied denied access to that money, and how many were denied, if you will?
Tens of thousands cases were found in the Office of Civil Rights. The Office of Civil Rights was closed at USDA under the Reagan administration in 1981, and it did not reopen until 1997. At that time, Secretary Glickman was the Agriculture Secretary, and President Clinton reopened the Office of Civil Rights, and they found tens of thousands of complaints in boxes with years of dust.
Wow.
Those persons were never given a class notification, and they fought us in federal court not to turn over those particular cases. And they won in court. They said that they did not have to notify those farmers. So many of the farmers didn't know that had filed legitimate cases here. And so we've had a very tough time with class notification, where many black farmers came after the filing deadline and said, "Hey, this happened to me as well. I was discriminated against, and I should have been a part of the lawsuit." So 80,000 black farmers came after the filing deadline. There were several hearings in Congress, and a bill that passed that was sponsored by then President Obama. Then he was a senator, sponsored that bill, and the Farm Bill that passed into law in 2008 that allowed these cases to move forward based on its merit. And here we are in 2010, still trying to get the funding for that case. So This has been just a long, drawn-out process for the black farmers, and many of the black farmers don't understand the political process, and they don't understand why we went to court, and we're still fighting to get the funding.
Now, how have Senate Republicans reacted to this whole case? I'm thinking of Michelle Bachmann, who said after the vote on Friday that the money from the Pickford case was being fraudulently claimed by farmers who were not discriminated against, or simply by people who were not farmers. Is that typical of many Senate Republicans?
Well, and she's in the House, Michelle Bachmann, and the consent decree says those black farmers who farmed and or attempted to farm, that could have been a sharecropper who's not counted by the census. This case has nothing to do with the census. And, for people like Congressperson Ms. Bachmann, who is a recipient of several hundred thousand dollars in the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program, I asked the question today, why isn't there an investigation of what's going on with recipients who receive farm subsidies who don't farm and getting received taxpayers' dollars who have never put a plow on the ground? And if you look at the farm subsidy program, during the last IG investigation, it said over $1 billion were paid out in the U.S. farm subsidy program to dead white farmers, who the families are still receiving checks on behalf of farmers who are no longer living. So there's other things that Ms. Bachman could be looking at versus trying to penalize a group of black farmers who proven their case in federal court. This is no longer allegations. We won in federal court, and we have a settlement agreement, and it needs to be funded, and it should be funded now.
Now, let's talk about then where exactly it stands at this point. We mentioned that the House still has to reconcile with this bill, but in what the Senate passed on, Senate passed last week, has the funding actually for the settlement been approved?
Well, the funding for the settlement was approved in the Senate, and it passed previously twice in the House, so it would have to go back to...
It just has to go back to the House now, and if the House passes it, then it would go to the president's desk.
It goes to the president to sign, and I've been working with the White House, and I'm sure that President Obama will sign this bill.
Now, with the reconfiguration of the House, which is now under Republican control, does there pose a larger hurdle for the House to pass this version of the bill?
Well, I'm going to be real honest with you. I would like to see the bill passed next week when they come back into session during lame duck. And I'm really not focusing after lame duck session. I think that we have a...
So you hope for it to happen right away before the new Congress people are seated?
Absolutely, and I'm urging the White House and leaders in the House to act swiftly, as did the Senate did, acted on this same bill during a lame duck session. I think it's very important that it happens during a lame duck session, and if it doesn't, we'll be amped to deal with more delays by Republicans who will be looking at replacing new committee chairs and things of that nature. So it'll be a while before they start putting their agenda into place, and I don't know if the black farmers would be the top priority under a Republican House. I haven't heard that as of yet. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to move this measure next week when Congress returns after Thanksgiving recess here.
If all goes as you hope, if the House passes it and it's signed by President Obama, what would the average award amount be? And is it comparable to the money farmers would have received in loans that they were denied or discriminated against?
It would be $50,000. And, you know, in today's farming capacity, that's not a lot of money. And it doesn't put the farmers back on the farm. But this case was all about justice, you know, getting justice for black farmers. And that's what this is, a form of justice and vindication. And that's the way that, you know, I see it. And I think that other black farmers see it the same way, that they will be able to move on with their lives. And this is also a case where it brings racial healing, you know, one step closer in this country, where this case continued to resurface all the time and had never been resolved. So I think by resolving this case, it sends the right signal that when there's a terrible injustice, that America does the right thing. And that's what happened in the Senate. The Senate done the right thing when they voted to, you know, move this measure forward so that black farmers and Native Americans could receive long overdue compensation for discrimination.
And how are black farmers currently treated today in terms of access to loans and treatment by federal agencies, those that are in business and still are on the farm?
Well, we have a lot of work to do at USDA, and there's a trust level, a trust factor that has to be broken here between the black farmers and USDA, where black farmers merely just don't trust the government. You're talking about years of discrimination and where we lost land and farms being foreclosed on, and very brutal treatment throughout the South. So it's going to take a long time to rebuild that bridge. But I think by settling this case and compensating the farmers that are involved in this process, it will send the right signal that USDA, you know, wants to, you know, bury the hatchet and move forward. So we have a lot of work to do where we're not taking part right now, currently. And the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program is something I've been fighting a long time. And we supported CAPS so that we thought that funds would trickle down to smaller producers, not just black farmers, but small farmers and Hispanic farmers and Indian farmers. Many of those groups are not taking part in a percentage-wise in the Farm Subsidy Program as well. And also, you've heard me talk before about the farm lending programs that black farmers certainly have been shut out of, and it takes such a long time to process a black farmer's loan application versus a white farm loan application. So we have a lot of work to do.
Well, I want to thank you, John Boyd, very much for joining us today. Is there a website for your organization or phone number?
Yes, it is, www.blackfarmers.org. That's www.blackfarmers.org. And we urge those who are listening who think they may be eligible to take part in this lawsuit to reach out to us and sign on to our e-blast so that we can keep them abreast of next steps in the process.
Blackfarmers.org is the website. John Boyd, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. John Boyd is the president of the National Black Farmers Association. And by the way, the other settlement that the Senate also approved was in the case of Cobell versus Salazar that was brought against the Department of Interior by Eloise Cobell, a member of the Blackfeet tribe from Browning, Montana. And we had covered that story in the past on Uprising. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the day, Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "Justice is a temporary thing that must at last come to an end, but the conscience is eternal and will never die." That's Martin Luther King Jr. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our interim assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Join us at facebook.com/uprisingradio. Follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio. Drop us an email at mail@uprisingradio.org. Our website is uprisingradio.org, where you can find local events and other information that we mentioned on the air, as well as listen to all of the programs. Again, the website, uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.